open the Senate Committee on Rules for January 20th, 2009. We have a number of items on the agenda. This is obviously the initial meeting in session for the Committee on Rules. I do have down here committee introductions. I do not know if that's necessary. Maybe the committee administrator would be one introduction that would be necessary.
My name is Lisa Nuss. I'll be the administrator for the Senate Rules Committee.
Okay.
And our assistant's going to be Brian Worley, and he's being assisted this morning by Aaron Seiler.
Okay, a lot of assistant.
I don't think that... Do the members need introductions?
It's at your pleasure, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I'd like to have Senator Burdick here, so why don't we do introductions? Senator Metzger.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26, and very, very excited to be on the Rules Committee this session.
I can feel the excitement here.
And you will.
I'm Senator Ted Farrioli, District 30, most of the rest of Oregon, all are part of 12 counties located east of the Cascades predominantly, beginning in Marion and Clackamas County and ending at the Idaho-Nevada border.
Senator Richard Devlin, Chair of the Committee, Senate District 19. Like us, we go west Lynn, Tualatin, and a little bit of lower southwest Tualatin, southwest Portland, and the Stafford Basin, which is my claim to being a rural legislator. Not a real claim.
My name is Jason Atkinson, State Senator, District 2, which is a big chunk of Southern Oregon. I've been on the Rules Committee since 1999 in the House of Representatives, and I'm the only member, at least in modern history, to have passed a minority report.
The member that is absent, Senator Jenny Burdick. We will go to the first item on the agenda, which is introduction, or went through introduction of committee members. We do need to adopt committee rules. You have the proposed rules before you. They're pretty standard rules for committees in this session. Do I have a motion on the proposed rules for the committee?
Question?
Yes.
Just for the record, a quorum is 3?
Yes.
Okay. And there's no other changes here regarding...
Now, the only other thing I think of significance, and we could probably debate that issue, what it means, and we'll probably debate that throughout the session, Section 18. That is the section that corresponds to the new provisions in the Senate rules about no measure shall be reported out of committee unless the written... It should go through the amendments. It has to have a fiscal impact statement and a revenue impact statement to come out of committee. That's the only significant change that I've seen in the rules.
And, Mr. Chair, one last question. We're on 48 hours at this point.
We are on 48.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I would move the rules as proposed.
Okay. It's been moved to approve the rules for the committee. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Motion passes. Now we will go to committee bill introductions. We only have one bill, actually, today. It's LC 230. Why don't the committee administrator just give a brief overview of that bill?
Sure. LC 230 is going to be introduced at the request of a member. It relates to the Long-Term Care Advisory Committee. Currently, of the members of the committee, four are appointed by legislative offices, including the Speaker, the President, the House and Senate Minority Leaders, and three appointments are by the Governor's Office. The current law provides that all of those members are confirmed by the Senate. The change would make it so that only the Governor's appointments would need to be confirmed by the Senate.
Okay. This is, again, a committee bill introduction. By introducing it, it's not a statement of support or opposition. Do we have a motion to introduce the bill? Or any questions?
So moved.
It's been moved to introduce LC 230. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, motion passes.
Yes.
Senator Burdick.
Yes, Senator Devlin.
Will you carry Just kidding.
Mr. Chairman, whatever you want me to do, I will do.
Yeah. Now, would you give a brief introduction, since the committee members went through a brief introduction, each member?
Okay, how long did Senator Atkins speak?
About 45 seconds.
Okay. All right, I'm Senator Jean Burdick. I represent District 18, which is Southwest Portland, and Tigard and King City. I chair the Revenue Committee, and I'm happy to be here as part of Rules and part of the group that will work on cleaning up Senate Bill 10.
Yeah, that was a good transition. The next item on the agenda, and it's put on the agenda largely so that the committee can start in earnest discussion of SB 10, is a discussion of the Ethics Reform Review Team report. And Dexter, can you come forward? And actually, I'll change my mind a little bit. Ms. Sidlick, why don't you come forward, too, just in case the committee has any questions. As you know, those members that were members during the interim, we have three pre-session filed bills. Those have been supplied to you. Those are just the beginnings of potential changes to SB 10. There are other things being discussed. But I thought it would be important for the committee, since it's now reconstituted in the regular session, to just hear an overview of what we think was very good work by the group that you were on, Dexter. And also because I think that they've made some specific, well, I shouldn't call them recommendations, alternatives for how to deal with certain issues. So I'll just basically turn it over to you, Mr. Johnson, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Good morning. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Counsel, and with me is Deputy Legislative Counsel Gina Zedlick, who is the Ethics and Elections Lawyer for Legislative Counsel. And basically what I'm going to do this morning is to walk through the report that I think you have in front of you that was prepared in the summer of last interim. And basically it was a legislative leadership in the spring of last year requested that I, along with Phil Schradl from the Department of Justice, Kelly Skye, General Counsel for the Governor's Office, and Marjorie Taylor from the Department of Administrative Services, that we take a look at the comprehensive ethics reform legislation that you passed in the 2007 session and the implementation of that, and gather public comment on that process and then the implementation of that process, and distill that for you and then present it for you, which we did to the interim joint ethics committees in the summer of 2008, and we are going to be doing that both this morning and on Friday on the House side. And let me give you just briefly a little bit of background on what happened, and you're very familiar with the 2007 process and the result, the resulting legislation from that. But as you know, that was really the first comprehensive review of ethics law in this state in more than 30 years. What had developed during the 30-year period was a a hodgepodge of changes to ethics law that at times was considered confusing and conflicting within itself and difficult to administer. And that in 2003-2004, that kind of led to the legislature beginning to really closely look at comprehensive reform. After the 2005 session, the governor, there was some comprehensive reform that was enacted in 2005 but was vetoed by the governor, and instead the governor directed the Oregon Law Commission to look closely at this and develop proposals. The Oregon Law Commission did so and presented those proposals to you in 2007. You looked at those proposals, made significant changes to them, and enacted what became Senate Bill 10 and House Bill 2597, I believe. 2995. And a number of other changes. As I've noted, they were very broad-based and sweeping. They gave a lot of new duties to the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, which is the entity charged with regulating and enforcing the ethics law in Oregon. And as a result of that, there was, for a long period of time after the 2007 enactments, significant confusion about what was meant and what the intent of the law was and what the changes were. These rose to a kind of a crescendo regarding a particular component, which was both part of the Law Commission's recommendations and was enacted by you, and that was concerning the Statement of Economic Interest, which is the form that public officials, not all public officials, but a long list of public officials are required to file with the Ethics Commission annually, and the quarterly reports that are related to that. As a result of the very public and loud objections to those forms in particular, and the ethics changes more generally, leadership asked our group to look at this, and what I'll do is turn to kind of our process and what we went through. Basically, we sat down as a group and met with representatives of League of Oregon Cities, the Association of Oregon Counties, Special Districts, the Port of Portland, and selected other associations, legislative liaison folks for those organizations, and discussed what their concerns were. We met with the Oregon Law Commission and discussed their process in developing their recommendations and their views on the implementation of Senate Bill 10 and the other ethics reforms legislation passed in 2007. Through the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties listservs, and through the DAS listserv, we solicited comments from essentially all public officials in this state and all individuals required to file statements of economic interest, and the public in general, and received approximately 300 comments from those individuals. And finally, we met on two occasions with the Government Ethics Commission and discussed their implementation of the legislation, their rollout of the new statements of economic interest, and their administrative rule review process and their training process. And as a result of all of those meetings and kind of digesting the information supplied to us, we presented this report to the interim committees and I'm walking through it with you now.
Yes.
Do you want to hold questions, or can I ask one about what he just said a minute ago?
Why don't you ask the question now, and then what I'd really like to get down to is the sort of what were the major issues and what were the alternatives. But the reason, if you have a question about process.
Thank you. I do have a question about process, and that's why I interrupted. You said that you received 300 comments from public officials and members of the public. How did that break down? How many comments did you get from people who were not public officials?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, the statistics on comments are on page 8 of the report. It's actually 268 comments precisely, of which 217 were from local government officials, 10 from judges, 7 from state officials, 13 from schools, and 21 from interested members of the public.
And was the nature, well, maybe it says so in here. I've seen this report, but I haven't reviewed it recently. Were most of them in the nature of criticism, or did you have supportive comments?
Yeah, most, the overwhelming majority actually were in the nature of criticisms, and most were directed at the statement of economic interest and the related quarterly reports.
Okay.
And I'll get into that in some detail.
Okay.
There were some, I don't mean to be too negative here, there were some positive reports, supportive comments about the reforms. And I'll also note that the comments that we received from the associations and professional lobbyists were different in nature. They were not particularly focused on the SEI as much as on some of the other changes in Senate Bill 10.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed.
So what I'd like to probably turn to first in terms of the report is the Government Ethics Commission and its processes in rolling out Senate Bill 10 changes in general and the SEI form in particular. The Government Ethics Commission is a small agency. It was an agency of three individuals on July 1, 2007. As part of this, you granted budget authority to them to hire three additional staff, which they did over the course of the next 6 months, an additional trainer, an additional person to provide written advice to you, and another staff individual. The commission also, during this initial period, moved offices from their office in the state archive building to a new office in South Salem. And those events, coupled with a demand for training, the commission undertook a lot of more than 30 training sessions during the period from July through February of 2008. And July of 2007 to February 2008, and began rulemaking process on rules implementing the 2007 legislation. All of that puts significant strain on the commission. They reported a great increase in requests for guidance on particular issues for which they attempted to respond, but they remain a small agency, and at least as of the time when we interviewed with them, their staffing concerns continue to be significant, their training demands continue to be significant, and their demands for written and or oral advice answering specific legal questions concerning the application of the ethics laws continued to be significant. Turning to their rollout of the Statement of Economic Interest form, which was a source of significant complaint for many of the folks who filed complaints with us. They didn't turn to that. The legislation required a newly designed form that asked different questions than previous versions of the form had. The commission turned to developing that form, which is due in April 15th, in January. It has historically not been a self-reporting form. That is one where if you think you need to file it, you go to the website and download it and fill it out and send it in, but instead a form that is mailed to a public official required to file it. And they continued that process this go-around so that the first part of getting the form to two folks is identifying, is the commission identifying who they were, who are the folks required to file the form. This proved to be more challenging this go-around than in the past because of changes made in the 2007 legislation that subjected a larger group of individuals to the form filing requirements. Specifically, the old ethics law had allowed public officials in cities and counties that had not voted for the original legislation to opt out of the SEI filing requirements. Both the Oregon Law Commission and recommended, and you adopted that recommendation to omit that, to eliminate that requirement, so that basically all there wasn't any geographic areas where public officials would not be subject to filing requirements if their job title required them to file an SEI. I go into detail about this because it's significant because it ended up resulting in the forms a long period of time going by where there was communication going back and forth between the Ethics Commission and cities and counties, particularly in rural areas that had not previously been subject to SEI filing, about who precisely were the folks who needed to file the form. That slowed down distribution of the form significantly, so that the end result was that the new form did not go out to public officials required to file the form until April 1st, and it's due April 15th. Also, during this long period where there was knowledge on the part of public officials that a new form was going to be due, but not a lot of knowledge about what was on the form, there was a real maelstrom of misinformation and concern about the questions that were going to be asked. Things like, am I going to have to report bank account balances and my net worth, and is all this going to be public information? There was a lot of that misinformation, and a lot of it was reported in the press, but I will say our findings, by the time the forms were actually distributed, was that public officials really did pretty much know what information was going to be required on them. Forms went out April 1st with this very rapid turnaround time. As I know you are all aware, the response, particularly at the local level of many individuals, public officials, to the forms was a great deal of concern about their intrusiveness, and particularly surrounding one question above all others, we found that really bothered many local public officials, and that was the listing of relatives, which the form required, which statutes require, but which was the single reason why there were so many objections to the form, and so many local, particularly volunteer public officials, ended up resigning as a result of the requirement that the form would have to be filed. Before I move on to our kind of going through the comments of the public on the form and other ethics concern, I did want to touch briefly on the other challenges of the Government Ethics Commission.
President, yes. Mr. Chairman, if I could just back up a second to the testimony about those that resigned. There were hundreds of resignations, and in some cases, whole planning commissions, whole city councils. And I just don't think we should overstep or overlook the disconnect that this created in rural Oregon, particularly in the counties that had voted to exempt themselves, who believed that they had already acted on the question. And many of the public officials, although they were aware of the ethics discussions that were going on in the building, were not aware that they needed to file until they actually got the form. And I think it's also important for us to note that I think there are only two paid mayors in the state of Oregon. So I don't suggest that the chief counsel is being dismissive by characterizing these people as volunteers. They are volunteers. But we're talking about city councilors, planning commission members, mayors, folks that literally provide all of the political infrastructure in some of these communities. So we saw at least a few very highly publicized initial resignations, and then there was a cascade of resignations. And there are still people who are very unsettled about the whole idea of this quarterly filing. So I just, you know, the facts probably don't really reflect the passion that we were hearing, especially in Eastern Oregon, where most of the exempt communities were located, a good number of them in District 30. So I hope I'm not belaboring the point, but I don't want us to minimize the idea that these folks were truly insulted and resigned en masse. And they, I don't know that all those positions are filled yet. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ferrioli, actually, on page 8 of the report, the second paragraph summarizes the statistics there, and you are correct. There were 203, as of May 20th, 203 public officials who resigned. And again, as of May 20th, there was approximately 758 SEI forms that had been required to be filed by April 15 that had not yet been filed. So there are large, were at that time, and there's no indication that there's any change of heart here, large numbers of people that were upset about the SEI. I just wanted to return briefly to the other Ethics Commission activities during this period, specifically the rulemaking and training and provision of written advice. The commission did undertake rulemaking in the areas of gifts and lobbyist reporting and other areas to implement the 2007 legislation. Those rules did not cover all possible rules that would be needed for implementing the 2007 legislation, but you will see what they primarily covered on page 6, lobbyist reporting and gift rules were adopted in March of 2008. And in addition, the commission, at the time that we interviewed them, their biggest task was answering both verbal and written requests for advice dealing with specific situations. And all indications that I've heard since then is that continues to remain a significant challenge for them. And so with that, what I'd like to do is distill for you the comments that we did receive, and as noted and as Senator Farioli has mentioned, the majority of those, again, deal with the SEI and concerns about that. The biggest single concern is the requirement in the Statement of Economic Interest that relatives and individuals residing in one's household be listed on the form. And this raised a host of concerns with individuals, but generally the feeling was that this was too intrusive and...
Mr. Johnson, can I clarify on that?
Yes.
The listing of relatives in the household, I think, is for those that had to file it, in terms of, that was one of the concerns in terms of how extended that, but it was the, wasn't it more the extended list of relatives, the that you'd have to list all of your siblings, brothers and sisters, and their spouses?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's
wives, kids.
And a number of comments were, in fact, concerns raised that this had, for particular individuals, opened up old wounds. They were siblings or ex-spouses who they hadn't communicated with in years, that suddenly they had to list these individuals. Others who, in fact, this was a number one reason cited for those folks who we heard from who had resigned was that their relatives had objected to the listing and therefore they felt they didn't have any choice but to resign. And there was, related to that, this was particularly true for the judges and district attorneys that we heard from, concerns about personal safety and identity theft that go along with the listing of relatives on the forms.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I think the one of the issues was that not only was it felt by some to be intrusive, but the information provided was useless. For instance, if your sibling's last name was Johnson or Smith or Jones, you weren't required to list the city in which they reside or the state. So the idea of creating a trackable document through the filing was an impossibility, since without any other identifier and a common surname, the information required was useless. It was a perfectly bureaucratic requirement, because the information produced was utterly pointless. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Johnson, in that regard, and we actually do have about, probably have no more than about 30 minutes left, because other people have to get ready for other meetings. Did we ever find a logical basis and record of why that was put into the statute, an extended list of relatives? I've heard different explanations, but most of them don't really hold up when you look into it.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I would like to do more research on that. I think the Law Commission discussed that, and it was cited in a report on page 3, though quickly glancing at it. Well, yeah, item D there as kind of in order to increase the scope of individuals for whom you'd be alert to the fact of gifts or other improper transfers occurring.
We won't get into a debate of that now, but
I'd be happy to do further research on that, though. Privacy issues were a particular concern with many individuals. There was concern that this would be a tool used to many public officials have to deal with harassing individuals who are frankly rather harassing at times, and this the concern was that this would expand the scope of people subject to harassment. Many public officials, as was noted before, are volunteers. Concerns were raised by many that this requirement would, it's already difficult for local governments to fill volunteer positions, and the intrusiveness of the report would make it even more difficult to recruit volunteers. There was overall a sense that the report, the kind of the perspective from which the report was coming from, was one of, oh, they don't trust us. And there was a lot of, many folks commented that this really rubbed them the wrong way, that this was, suddenly they were, the presumption was they were doing something wrong, and this report was designed to catch them. We heard that from a lot of individuals. A great deal of concern about internet access. As you know, the 2007 legislation requires the report to SEI files and the quarterly reports to be posted on the internet beginning in 2010. A lot of concern about that. Folks noted the qualitative difference between public record requests. All of these forms are public records, so anyone can request them, but you can't make a public records request anonymously. Looking on the internet, of course, is entirely anonymous. A lot of individuals highlighted that difference. Interesting comments made from a number of individuals who felt that the SEI filing and that whole process was a reflection of urban values being imposed on rural areas. Again, most of the comments we received were from rural areas, so, but a lot of them reflected that comment. Concern about excessiveness with the quarterly reports, which for many public officials, there's no information reported on the public, on the quarterly reports. As number of people said a reasonable solution to that would be to require the filing of the quarterly report only if there is new information to report. I think you can see the other comments listed there on Senate Bill 10, on page 10, not Senate Bill 10, and I think we've touched generally on that. So I'd like to turn, I know time is limited, to some of the comments we received on issues unrelated to the SEI. And those, the biggest of those comments concerns the interplay of two laws that use the term legislative and administrative interest, but don't quite use it exactly the same way, and there isn't... there's concern about how they don't fit together particularly well. Legislative and administrative interest in terms of the definition is focused on an individual. Does an individual have a legislative or administrative interest? But the gift limit, the term is used in the gift limit, but it applies, it appears to apply more broadly to does an individual have a legislative or administrative interest with the entity which the public official is associated with? And so there's that has caused a lot of confusion. Public official, as you know, is also broadly defined in the ethics laws. We received a number of comments urging that volunteers or contractors perhaps be excluded, or that there be some work done to refine that definition so that it is narrower. A number of public officials, and these were basically fairly lower-level public officials, described situations where they would do volunteer work with another organization, and their work with that organization would be hampered because of the gift limitation. And a great example that came to mind, police officers routinely volunteer with youth groups. And if the youth group receives, and they serve as mentors to youth, and if the youth group were to receive, for example, tickets to the Blazers game, and the idea would be that the mentor would accompany the youth that he's mentoring to the game, well, suddenly that would be a violation of the gift limitation. And there was a number of examples that are similar to that folks raised concerns about. Also, just more broadly, there's a lot of logistics and administrative concerns about how these limitations are actually implemented by various organizations. And particularly this came true in the context of public bodies and nonprofit bodies that have shared missions and in the past have worked together. And suddenly, in order to continue that work, the nonprofit organization in particular is faced with a lot of challenging riddles to figure out about complying with the ethics law. Again, similar to with the experience with that folks reported about the SEI filings, there is a sense overall with these limitations that there's an intrusiveness into public officials' private lives. Consideration about you attend somebody's birthday party, and you would have anyways, but suddenly you have to think about the kind of gift you give the person. What about public officials who have a personal relationship together? All kinds of challenging issues come to the fore in those contexts. Again, the gift limitation and is another area where comments reflected concern that there would be it would hamper the recruitment of volunteers, and so many of these positions are in fact volunteer positions. So that was kind of in a nutshell the kind of distillation of the comments that we received. Committee Services does, by the way, have about six binders worth of comments that are somewhere. We haven't quite located them, but they will be available to you sometime in the next couple of weeks.
Can we blame it on the fire?
Yes. Yeah. Fire caused a lot of chaos. They didn't get burned up, though. So they will be available for you to peruse. And with that, what I'd like to do is turn to what I would describe as options that you may consider, but the way I would describe them as mere stars in the universe of choices that you have.
Before you do that, I did need to... We're having a little bit of problem with the recording for the session. And appears that we'll get some clarification on this. It appears that cell phones not only need to be silenced, they need to be off, actually.
Okay.
So.
Yes, that's what I've been told by audio.
Yeah.
Okay. So, as I said, this is certainly not all of the choices that you have in front of you, just a few select highlights. And I'll note that most of the ethics review team, myself included, we actually don't make recommendations, so these are not recommendations. These are just options for you to consider. biggest one in terms of comments was the listing of relatives. So that's certainly something that you may want to think about, the need for that in general, or if there's continues to be a desire for it, then perhaps modifying the disclosure of that information so that it is, in fact, over at the Ethics Commission but not generally disclosable. In particular, posting of the SEIs on the Internet, as I said, was a big concern to a lot of folks. Other information on the SEI could, many comments were that this felt that they put themselves, if they were small business owners, at a commercial disadvantage with others, potentially. So again, that information, you may want to consider making that not subject to public disclosure. Listing of sources of income, there comments about that were interesting. That was one of the recommendations from the Law Commission, that the previous requirements, there had been a lot of folks concerned about those as being too complex, so this was a very simple one. You'd list the top five sources of income. And a number of those comments were, from folks were, that would mean item three would be what I got at the garage sale last week. I mean, kind of things where there really is no, many public officials don't have five significant sources of income, so you might want to consider a floor before any of that kicks into play. The biggest group of complainants, folks that filed comments complaining about the requirements, were from the 1974, the cities and counties that in 1974 exempted out of this process and have, as a result of the 2007 legislation, now been subject to it. So an option you may consider would be returning to the 1974 status in terms of who's subject to it and who isn't, or perhaps modifying that so that it would be based on more fixed population thresholds or something of that nature. The quarterly report, which, as you know, is filed, that is a one that you are required to print and fill out yourself. It's not mailed to you, unlike the SEI. Many people felt that was unnecessary or intrusive, and so there could be options you could explore about either eliminating that or only requiring its filing if there's some information, in fact, to report on it, measures like that. The definition of legislative and administrative interest, as I mentioned before, it doesn't line up with how it's used, and so you may want to consider some language changes to make the definition and the way it's used in the gift limitation fit a little bit more closely. That would eliminate a lot of ambiguity around application of the gift limitation. Definition of public official is another area where you may want to review changes, particularly as it applies to volunteers. Many of the concerns, again, were that this makes it more difficult. It's already hard to recruit volunteers for many of these positions, and these requirements make it much more difficult to do so. The Ethics Commission, as I noted at the beginning, is a small agency. It's tasked with a lot of work, and their training and questions and responding to questions continues. My understanding is they are attempting to become more of a online presence, so that many of these forms can be filed online versus in the paper method. All of that, you may wish to consider. They are a small agency. You may wish to consider expanding their resources to meet these needs. And finally, and this is one of the things that kind of came to the fore when we were talking with both the Law Commission and the Ethics Commission. Being a small agency, some of the stuff that they were required to do that they don't do every day, in fact, they maybe only do once a decade, like developing new instructions for a new form or conducting a press relations in a sophisticated way. A larger agency could help them with that, like DAS, for example. And this would be true for not just Ethics Commission, but many small agencies where suddenly, once in a decade, they're faced with a big task. A lot of the infrastructure needed to successfully do that would be available to exists in a larger agency, and right now there isn't a mechanism for having a small agency ask for that help, and that may be something you'd want to consider as well. With that, as I said, that is just a slice of the choices you have available to you. Those are not recommendations either. They're just things for you to consider, but with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Before we go to questions, and I'll go first to Senator Burdick on questions, the purpose today was simply to provide a sort of an informational overview, hoping that people would retain the report. We do have actually three bills that have been pre-session filed and have had first readings. There are modifications being made in those bills as we speak. But just to get people basically starting to think about this in some level of detail before the bills actually come before the committee, or a bill comes before the committee. So, Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dexter, do you have the stars in the galaxy in writing, that little summary you just gave,
that
you could provide to us? Is that it?
That is in the report. It begins on page 12.
Okay.
And that's the last five pages of the report.
I thought it might be. Okay, thank you. And you didn't add anything today because this report was done in May.
I have not added anything today, no.
Thank you.
Any questions? Well, thank you very much. I did want to say, though, too, that the reason I have, am I pronouncing this correctly, Ms. Zedlick?
Mm-hmm.
The reason I have Ms. Zedlick here is she's the legislative counsel that will be doing all the work, much of the work of the Rules Committee, to be honest, given some of the nature of the work, but all the work on revisions to SB 10. So that's the person you need to go see.
Don't, Mr. Chair, do not attend any potlucks.
So we do have a meeting scheduled for Thursday. We actually have two bills up that are for hearing only. And with that, if there are no other questions, we'll be adjourned for today. Thank you very much. We'll figure out what